Hi, and warm welcome to Conversations with My Mind. My name is Anne Tavanaga, and I am the host of this podcast. If you are here for the first time, you have joined a podcast about us, about our minds, about achieving our goals, and enjoying life with awareness of our mental health. This is a safe audio virtual space where we meet inspiring people to talk to relate to, and where we can learn from each other and inspire each other to take the actions that will benefit all of us. Today, you have joined me for an expert episode on meditation and mindfulness. My guest, Alex Reynolds, is a highly skilled quality engineer, but what I am really interested in is his over 20 years of experience in meditation, which he has also introduced in his workplace. In the last 3 years, he has given his talk on mindfulness and meditation to more than 6,000 colleagues, and his mindfulness and meditation community already has over 1,700 members, and it's growing every day. In this episode, we will talk about Alex's journey, his experience of bringing mindfulness into the corporate world, and we will also chat about stress, why we experience it, and how meditation and mindfulness can be an essential tool for managing it and also improving our well-being. Alex, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm so happy to have you here. Welcome to Conversations with My Mind.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I will start by asking, how are you today? How are you dealing with this heat that has even reached us here in Scotland?
It's a strange sensation when it is too warm in Scotland. You know, the conversations you tend to have with people, you know, yes, it's too warm. It's like, but you're in Scotland. I know, it can happen. Yes, it's very odd. Although I'm glad to say it's not as hot as some of my colleagues who were experiencing 32 degrees where they were down in the further reaches of England. So yes, it's not quite as warm as that, thankfully.
When it's roasting in Scotland, it's usually like 22 degrees.
Yeah. It's what we refer to in Scotland as taps aff weather. So when you can see all the guys in the work sites just taking their tops off, that's it. So yeah, you know when it's reached the right level of the heat in Scotland, when you can see that happening everywhere.
That was my first like really big confusion when I moved over to Scotland. Like my colleagues would be complaining about we're roasting. Like obviously that's a big term here. Like everyone's roasting, but they're roasting from 17 degrees upwards.
Yeah, it's very true. It's very, very true. Our experience of temperature is very different to the rest of the world, I think. I think we'd get on well with Canadians. They seem to get the kind of the cold weather as well, so they understand a bit what we're like. So yeah, it's very, very interesting.
And what also has confused me is the winter jacket's on now when it's been like about 20 degrees, but the tops are off when the first sun comes out in the spring and it's maybe like 9 outside.
Yes, it tends to be an on or off situation. Yeah, that's the thing. We've got, as soon as there's a bit of sunshine, it's like, oh, the sunshine's out. Well, let's get these pasty white bodies burned, shall we? That's what it's all about, it seems to be. We'll go from milk bottle clear to like slightly white and then just big pink. That seems to be the shades of human experience in Scotland.
Brilliant. Oh, yeah. I could talk about this forever. I will start by a very simple question for you today. Could you describe from where you sit, who is Alex Reynolds?
Oh, crikey. That's an interesting question. For me, I think firstly, I'm an engineer. You know, I'm an engineer at heart. I've always had a passion for engineering since I was quite young. But at the same time, I kind of struggled against a very creative side I had. So frustrated artist is a term that I often use. I always enjoyed drawing, painting. I've done a bit of kind of stage work. You know, I used to do kind of amateur dramatics. I've even appeared in a film, which a friend of mine made, which went to festivals and stuff and was quite good. So I've done lots of varying things. And I suppose that's one of the key things. I've got lots of very different interests. Some of them complement each other quite well. Some of them don't. But with each of them, I do get something out of it for myself, either tie into a value kind of close to me, or it's just a way of expressing myself in a slightly different way that the kind of the day job, the engineering side of it, doesn't always give me. So yeah, for me, I suppose, to sum up, a frustrated artist, creative person who loves engineering, and I have a passion for mental well-being and mindfulness as well. That's a nice little package, isn't it?
Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I had no idea about the artsy drama side of yours.
Yeah, it was something, it's funny, it was one of those things that I fell into as a kind of young adult. A friend of mine asked me to come along to an amateur dramatics play one time. I said, oh, I can't do that. I'm far too shy for that kind of thing. And believe it or not, I was a very shy child. And I also suffered from I used to suffer from proper anxiety. There's no way I could go onto stage or like even be out in front of people. But it was one of those things that kind of helped me, kind of just a slight exposure to going out on stage or doing little bits of piece. And I started off in the back, you know, as like just one of the people that stood in the back and did some really bad dancing, to eventually going up on stage and having parts and things like that. I think that really helped me. Come out my shell was the term that we use up here. So yeah, that's what it was.
Practice makes perfection.
Hopefully.
I do want to speak most about mindfulness and meditation today. For me, that was like quite interesting story. I obviously saw mindfulness and meditation as something quite distant. I went to one meditation camp maybe 10 years ago, and it was really spiritual. There was this guy who was standing on his head all the time and speaking about his spiritual journeys to India, and it was just really, really awkward experience for me. So I put it to bed for a good 5 years or so. But then I came across mindfulness, and I was really interested in, well, what is that? And actually, when I finally started learning about my own depression and anxiety that I sometimes experience, I was looking for tools to help me cope better with it. And I was trying to find some common ground with my mind. And mindfulness turned out to be something that really did help at the time, and still does. What I would love to say is that I have mastered it now, and I'm really doing it every day, and it's great. But in reality, I am still learning. I'm still trying things out. I'm still negotiating with myself every day and week to do it or not to do it. And I am really looking forward to hear your story, how your experience came about. How did you find meditation or mindfulness? What made you become interested in it?
Oh, it's a funny thing. I often think, did I find mindfulness, or did it find me? So again, I suppose a bit like you, that there was a time in my life where I was kind of in my early 20s, and I'd finished university, I'd moved out of my mum and dad's house, I'd started my first proper job as a software engineer. And I think, like a lot of young men, a lot of young adults, in fact, I felt properly overwhelmed by the change, you know, that kind of big change, going from something fairly secure, you know, high-level education. I'd never been outside of school. I hadn't really even had a proper job up until that time. So it was like a big kind of scary deal. And like a lot of young people, I felt properly overwhelmed. And I often say to people, I went on a spiritual journey. Basically, I went to the pub a lot with my mates. And we tried to, you know what it's like when you're that age, you're always discussing the kind of, you know, one, the girls you fancy, but you'd also kind of try and talk about the bigger subjects, you know, why are we here? What's the point in all this? What are we doing? And I think I used to be quite introspective about this, and I would find myself kind of spiraling into these kind of conversations and really trying to kind of lift the lid on it. And through these conversations and trying different things, I suppose, I thought, you know, somebody suggested, have you heard of, you know, Zen Buddhism? I was like, oh, no, I've not. I'll read up about that. So I kind of read some of that. I read the Dharma. I went to a couple of meetings, and then, you know, went on a retreat, and yeah, tried things like that. And through these various experiences, I kind of landed on meditation. My first experience of meditation was through a chap called Jack Kornfield, who was like, I suppose, like the American godfather, alongside kind of John Kabat-Zinn and kind of those kind of people of the mindfulness movement in America. And like a lot of people, especially, we're talking 20 years ago, so the concept of mindfulness wasn't really being talked about. It was much more meditation. And it goes back to the kind of experience you mentioned there, that was a very spiritual experience. It was, you know, less about the kind of the secular approach that we have now. And I think for me that worked, because at that time in my life, I suppose I was quite a spiritual person. I was struggling with spirituality as well, and I didn't know, you know, I was a lapsed Catholic. I was slightly Christian. I think, like a lot of people, I was struggling with religion at that time, and it answered a lot of questions. The Buddhism didn't stick, as did the Catholicism. You know, neither of those things stuck, but the meditation did. I'm glad to say it did, actually. I'm really, really glad to say it did. Certainly wouldn't be talking to you today about it, or anybody else for that matter, I don't think. But yeah, it was an interesting journey, and there's been, you know, I still struggle with meditation. You mentioned there about you find it difficult. You know, one of the best stories I got told on my journey through, you know, kind of learning meditation, and even after 20 years, I struggle with it on a daily basis, was from a retreat I was on. Buddhist monk that was leading the session that day, he was talking about his teacher. And his teacher had been meditating for something like 45, 50 years. And in their tradition, they have meditation beads. And they count up to 100 breaths. So they're breathing in and out, count one, breathing in and out, count two, and so on and so forth. And he got to 99. And inside his thoughts, his thoughts went, oh, I'm almost at 100. That's amazing. Oh, no, I've missed it. and it went back to one. So, you know, even someone after years and years and years of meditation can still struggle with it. But the interesting take that he took on that was that even after that, he said that still gave him an opportunity to practice mindfulness, to practice that moment of, oh, I've lost my concentration, I can bring it back to my breath. And I think that's a nice rephrasing of it. Instead of getting frustrated with our minds doing what they're supposed to do, we can just accept that's what they're doing and just gently guide ourselves back to our breath. So yeah, so my journey has been, it's pretty much been that up until, you know, like I say, it took me about 3 or 4 years to really start to get my practice settled of doing it at least once or twice a day. And there's been times when that's dropped by the wayside. There's, you know, other stresses come in and other things take over, but it's always a kind of a useful practice to come back to. So that's about it, really. I think that was the journey. It's not a very exciting story, but it was an interesting time in my life. I think it took me about 4 or 5 years to properly settle into meditation being the thing that would stick with me.
What was the key reason why you stuck with meditation and mindfulness?
I suppose more than anything else, it's the easiest thing to do. You know, out of all the things that I tried, you know, I'd done things like, I tried mindful movement, so I'd done Tai Chi, which was interesting, it was good, and I quite enjoyed the class and everything, but it involved having to get up, and I'll be honest with you, I was in my 20s, I was a bit lazy, but it involved having to get out and go and do things and get involved with people and things like that. And I tried other things, and it was always group events, and I suppose, although I love being in and amongst people, you know, I'm very much an extrovert in that sense. I do like having time to myself. I enjoy the kind of introspection. I enjoy reflection time. And that's what mindfulness gave me more than anything else. And initially it was, I would take long kind of mindful walks. And that was something I found really useful. You know, it's something that a teacher suggested to me because I found it difficult initially just sitting down and sticking with the meditation. He said, try mindful walking. And where I lived at the time was right next to a beautiful park in Livingston called Howden Park. And I would just go for walks through Howden Park and just listen to the birds and listen to my footfall, concentrate my breath. And by doing that in an active way, I was then able to kind of transfer some of that into my sitting practice. But there was no one moment that kind of struck me as this is the thing for you. It was just more of a gradual, I suppose it became a gradual habit. And eventually it became such a habit that I would miss it when I didn't do it. Mm. If that makes sense. So it was much more the habit became the crucial thing for me. It was once I had the habit in place, and then I could start to explore the different types of meditation. And I suppose like a lot of things, I got a bit obsessed with it. Like I wanted to know what different types of meditation there were. You know, transcendental meditation. I tried that for a bit. That was really interesting. I tried yoga. I tried all sorts of different things and wanted to find out more about it. And it just kind of became part of me. You know, I suppose that's the thing. It just became part of who I was. And I'd have no problem saying to people, I'm just going away to meditate for a little while. And they're like, I know what he's, Alex, that's fine. So I went and did my meditation. So, yeah, it's just one of those things. And I think a lot of my friends probably got bored of me talking about it a lot of the time. Because I suppose, you know, we're talking 20 odd years ago. It wasn't as mainstream as it is today. It's not as accepted as it is today. You know, you can have a conversation with people about meditation, and most people will have heard about what it is and will know a little bit. It's the classic thing, I always say this at the start of my talks, what's the first thing that pops into your mind when you hear the term meditation? And most people will say Buddhist monks or they all go, you know, they put their fingers together and go, that's the usual thing. And that's still the main experience for a lot of people. And back 20 years ago, that was, you know, only the thing that people had heard about. It was Buddhism equaled meditation. This kind of concept of mindfulness didn't exist then. Certainly in the UK, not so much in the States, I suppose. So for me, it was like everybody thought, all right, he's becoming a swami, he's becoming like a guru, you know, he's like, that's it, oh, it's just Alex, it's just what he does. And so I started to talk about it less and less, and it became very much a private thing. It became very much my thing, and I just didn't talk to people as much about it. I was very passionate about it early on, and then as I started to get more into my career and more into the engineering side, I still did the meditation, but I just didn't talk about it as much. So yeah, that was there was no one moment, I suppose, really.
Interesting. And what made you almost come out to public again and start speaking about
come out?
I don't know if it's the right term.
No, it's an interesting one. Actually, this is a really clear memory. So about 5 years ago, just before the birth of my second son, so about 5.5 years ago, I was sitting in the office, and the job that we did, we worked in IT, so it was a very delivery focused. I was doing, I had a number of different hats on, as quality engineering, I was doing defect management, doing kind of test management, all sorts of different things. And it was stressful. It was always very stressful. It was very delivery focused, that you were moving from one release to the next and you were just trying to get through everything. And I always looked around and I thought, why do I not seem as stressed as everybody else around me? You know, what was the thing? Why are, you know, the people sitting next to me just up to, as we say in Scotland, up to high dough? They just always seem to be really, really kind of stressed about everything. And over the slightest little thing, you know, like I remember one time watching a colleague just almost losing their temper completely because somebody put an apostrophe in the wrong place in a test document. I was like, it's just an apostrophe. But it was this kind of constant pressure. And yes, that might have just been the posture, but that wasn't the thing that was bothering them. It was the situation they were in, this kind of constant grind that they were in. And this kind of cult of busyness almost that we seem to see in corporate environments. You know, people feel the need to be busy and seem to be busy.
Yeah.
So I thought, why don't I experience that in the same way? And I kind of landed on the fact, well, maybe it's my meditation practice. I remember chatting to my wife about this. My wife's a clinical psychologist. I think I'm her case study for the last 10 years. But we were talking about this one night, and she said, "Well, why don't you talk to people in your work about mindfulness? Why don't you develop a little bit of a course or something?" I thought, "Why not? Yeah, let's do that." So I did. So we sat down and we wrote a little 6-week course, just introducing the very bare bones of a mindful meditation practice. Nothing like the mindfulness-based stress reduction courses or, you know, body works or anything like that. It was just, you know, here's the things that I've learned over my time, here's the things that work for me, and I'm just introducing the various types of meditation that I knew about. So I ran that course, and it went really well. We had 12 people attend every single lunchtime for 6 weeks, which is incredible. I remember saying to my wife, and she went, "Every week?" And I went, "Yeah, 12 people every week." She went, that's amazing. You don't get people like that in courses when I do them. And I was like, maybe it's just me. So when that happened, and it was very successful, and I planned to kind of do another one, and then our second child came along, and sleep became far more important than doing anything else outside of that kind of the fun stuff at work. And then about a year, maybe 6 months to a year after that, a colleague asked me, "Oh, you know a little bit about mindfulness, don't you? Would you mind doing like a talk to my team?" And I thought, yeah, okay. So I took some of the stuff that I'd done in this kind of 8-week course, and I condensed the start of it into a talk that could be a gentle introduction to what mindfulness is, do a little bit of practice, and, you know, explain, you know, why we get stressed, what stress is, how it impacts us, but really focus on the kind of science stuff, moving away from any of the kind of religious connotations associated to meditation, and purely just focus on the secular practice of mindfulness and why it works. And that was, like I say, almost 4 years ago. And then from that time, it just kind of started to snowball. You know, and it's funny, when you start to put yourself out there and put yourself out there behind something you really believe in, I think you always attract like-minded people. People just seem to kind of come to you, or you start to get into their area of influence. And that just started to happen. You know, when I was talking to people about meditation, you know, this was all just within the IT department that I worked in. And eventually it just kind of started to seep out, and people started to reach out to me and say, "Oh, you're Alex Reynolds, aren't you?" I was like, "Yes, and you are?" He says, "Oh, I've heard about you. Would you mind having a chat?" I was like, "Yeah, sure." And it just started to kind of go from there, almost like a snowflake. Mm-hmm. And eventually, about 18 months ago, this was actually before COVID, about 2 years ago, I thought, I can't do this on my own. I wonder if there's other people that would really like to kind of make a go of this. And I thought, right, I'll just set up a community. And so I set it up, asked for people to get involved, and people did. And that was, I think that was the most surprising thing. And now we've gone from being, you know, like a group of 10 people to almost 1,700 people. We've got a core leadership team of 8, and then about another 5 or 6 kind of ambassadors that help support us. It's just absolutely incredible to kind of see that happen. And I've been so lucky with some of the people that I've kind of come in contact with. You know, some people I really consider my close friends now. So Mel Edley, who's no longer with the company, she's moved on and now doing lots of really cool things in mindfulness and meditation. I met her purely by chance, and she was just a fantastic person to talk to, such a kind person and so generous with her time. And I learned a lot from her. I'd learned a lot from the experience, and likewise, people who are in the community now, both my friend Alison McIntosh and Alex Zambas, who are kind of core members of the team, they were really supportive of each other, and they know my weaknesses, and my weaknesses are basically I'm sometimes too passionate and I try and push it too quickly, and I need to slow down an awful lot, and they help me, they kind of guide me to say, no, we need to be a bit more careful with this, like, you're right, sorry, I'll rein it in. So it's that kind of thing. It's a real good example of people coming together, and I think communities of practice and communities around a topic are a great opportunity to meet like-minded people, but also to learn from those people and, you know, kind of really extend your kind of scope of influence and understand more about yourself. So I've learned a lot about myself as being part of this community, because when you're reflecting things off of people, you start to say, okay, right, I need to think about how I'm doing this. And the people that have got involved are all, some of them are senior leaders, actually. So I've actually learned a lot about leadership through that and my own skills and my own failings and you know, the opportunities that I can get to kind of shape where I want to go with this. So it's been a wonderful journey, and I don't know where it's going to go. I'll be honest with you. I mean, I'd love to see our organisation do the same thing as other large corporate organisations. You know, so I've been lucky in my time to kind of chat to people like Matt Champion at SAP, who is fantastic, and the work that they do across the SAP is amazing. They've got a huge mindfulness programme that they've set up there, and Matt's one of the guys that supports it, and they're just really indoctrinating it into everything they do. You know, it's not just about doing a mindful practice. They're asking people to be mindful in their communication style. They're asking people to be mindful, wow, in the way they deal with their relationships. It's really kind of thoughtful. Mindfulness is ingraining it into their culture. And then other companies, you know, Mary Thurman over at HSBC, they've done fantastic work with Awareness, and a chap called Chris Tamjiri, who's one of those people that when you talk to him for 5 minutes, I think I'm passionate about mindfulness, and then I talk to Chris, and I'm like, wow, it's like talking to a superhero, you know, someone who knows the subject so much more deeply, but also has done all the research behind it and works and breathes and lives it. When you talk to people like that, you cannot help but feel inspired. And, you know, every time I have these conversations with people like Chris, I get like that. But anyway, the work that they've done across in Working Mind programme, which has now gone global, you know, HSBC have gone global with their programme. The thing with all these companies is they're seeing significant benefits. You know, a lot of these places have got mindfulness officers in place. You know, there's a mindful director now in Denton's Law.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible. They're taking it seriously. You know, Scott Shull of LinkedIn, he is the chief compassion officer. It's lovely to see that shift in leaders. You know, it's gone from being that very much kind of almost like dynamic approach to, you know, this is what you do, we must work 9 to 5, we must do this many hours, you know, it's all about the bottom
command
line.
And control.
Yeah, this command and control approach, yeah. And to see this subtle shift into being, you know, compassion focused. And you even see it in some of the leadership across the pandemic's a great example. You look at the way the leadership's gone across the world, you know, like Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, you know, took that compassionate approach. And also Nicola Sturgeon, she's took that same sort of approach, that compassionate approach to just kind of inspire people to kind of take care of themselves and to take care of others. And I think when you look at that, when you look at that compassionate approach, it helps build in trust to people. And so we're seeing this kind of groundswell, we're seeing this this wave of meditation and mindfulness practice going out across the corporate world. And it's really starting to change people. It's really starting to change how we do things. And I think it's a really exciting time to be involved in that area. For me, certainly, I've learned so much from the people that are around us. And the generosity from everybody when you say to them, oh, I'm trying to set up a meditation community, they say, right, okay, how can we help you? And that's something that's really, it's inspiring. And at the same time, kind of humbling as well, because you're like, wow, people are genuinely wanting to help. You know, and it's not very often that you experience that in a corporate environment. Sometimes it's like, it sometimes feels like a bit like a dog eat dog world, and people just trying to push over you to get into the next rung of the ladder. But with being in the mindfulness stuff, I think that's been much more akin to my value set and being around people that experience and have those same values is a lovely place to be. And I think it's probably why I enjoy it so much and get so much out of it personally.
It's been lovely to watch you grow, the community grow. I first attended a small session in one of our offices, and since then to what it is now, it's just, it's fantastic.
Yeah. It is. I mean, we've been kind of lucky with some things. Like COVID coming along when it did, it was one of those things, you know, it's a terrible thing to have happened. But at the same time, it helped our community kind of get a bit of a spotlight on what we were doing. We kind of rallied quite quickly. We thought we need to do something to support some of our colleagues. So when first started back in March 2020, we thought, okay, well, how can we support colleagues? Well, let's do a daily mindfulness call. So that's what we did. We did a daily mindfulness session, 8:30 every morning for the people that were in lockdown. And we thought, if we get five people, that'll be great. You know, five people will be fine, you know, as long as if it's supporting someone. And then we started to get, you know, 15 and then 20 and then 50 and then 75 people. And I think at one point we had 120 people attending these morning calls. And we were like, wow, this is quite scary. And we're still doing them. We're still doing those calls. And that settled down because it's at 8:30, it's at prime school run time. So we like people are always going away. But we've refined the process now that we're able to use things like Microsoft Teams, which has made things much easier for us to manage. And people can then come on later on and check out the stream that's available and do the meditation at their own time. But we're still doing that every day, and we're still getting between 50 and 60 people every day. And that's not the same 50 or 60 people. It's about, I think the last count we checked, it was 410 people come to the daily meditations on various days throughout the month. So it's remarkable. And just to know that there are people that want to do that with each other, I think there's a real sense of belonging when you're with a group of people and you see the same faces on that Teams meeting. You go, oh, you know, Dave's doing it again today. That's nice to see. You know, you know you're doing your meditation almost like with friends, I suppose. There's definitely something. And I know studies have shown that group meditation, there's a thing that happens with group meditation that, you know, your meditation is more effective when you know you're doing it with people.
Interesting.
You find it easier to do meditation when you know there's other people doing it, and there's a support, almost like an invisible support that happens. You find you get more out of the meditation when you know you're doing it with people. Be that in a room or virtual, which is really interesting. The fact that doing it virtually online, just the fact that you knowing that you are doing meditation with other people is a comforting thing, and it makes it easier for you to get into the meditation and to maintain it.
That's brilliant.
So it's really interesting.
That's really, really interesting. I did not know that. So we have been mentioning mindfulness and meditation quite a few times in this conversation. Can you please explain the difference between the two?
Right, this is an interesting one. So meditation really does come from, you know, the religious world. A lot of people always associate it with Buddhism, and rightly so. You know, meditation is one of the kind of core precepts of Buddhism. It's one of the things that Buddhists use to practice clarifying the mind and using it to answer questions about their own faith and religion. I think actually, the memory serves me right, meditation actually predates Buddhism by about 2,500 years. And I think it started off with something in the Hindu faith called the Vedas. And again, these were ways of meditating on subjects to look at the truth of the subject. Meditation was never about being relaxed. It was never about kind of reducing your stress. It was about creating a clarity of mind. And so it was about being able to create clarity in your mind so you could ask yourself the big questions and get a more spiritual, deeper answer. And then we kind of fast forward many, many years. And, you know, we've got people like John Kabat-Zinn and Jack Kornfield, who trained in Buddhism and Buddhist practice and also had kind of, is a psychologist. So, you know, taking these ideas, you know, that they discovered through their love of meditation, their love of kind of Buddhism and the whole approach to this kind of way of accepting life and accepting suffering, and trying to build that into something that could be used in a Western culture, is where meditation starts to drop off and mindfulness comes in. So mindfulness essentially is a secular practice. So it takes away the religious connotations. At its core, if you look at a mindfulness practice and a meditation, they completely cross over. They're essentially doing the same thing, you know. So if you're doing like a compassionate meditation or a metta bhavana within Buddhism and a compassionate meditation within a mindfulness practice, they're very, very similar. You know, they're almost exactly the same. Some of the wordings change slightly, but they're very, very similar practices. And the idea behind the kind of mindfulness is it extends from the practice into life. So you do the practice, you do your body scan, you can do your mindfulness on breath, you could do your focus on breath, you could compassionate or your visualization meditation, whatever form that takes, for anything between 3 minutes and 2 hours. If you can get 2 hours, which is amazing. If I can get 3 minutes, is amazing, actually. But if you can get that time. And this idea is that then spills out for you to be mindful in other ways. So whether that's being mindful making a cup of coffee, or brushing your teeth. Brushing your teeth is a great example of a mindful activity that you can really absolve yourself in. Shaving, although I don't do that anymore since I've grown my beard, but you know, shaving is another one. You know, you can be really mindful in that. Washing the dishes, but just noticing things. For example, mindful walking and mindful running. I do mindful running as well. I try to run a couple of days a week, and I used to run like everybody else. I put the headphones on, lose myself in the music, and kind of pound the streets. And again, it was a friend of mine, someone I respect with very much about the mindfulness practice, they said to me, "You tried it without the headphones, just run." Like, I never thought of that. So I tried it, and tuning into, you know, your heart rate, tuning into your breath, tuning into your stride, tuning into what the weather's doing, becoming mindful of where you are. I actually found the runs were much easier, and I got more involved in the run as well. So it spells out, and that's what mindfulness is about. It's about bringing that kind of complete awareness to everything you do in your life. So noticing what's going on within your mind, your body, everything in between, and total awareness of what's around you. As I say to my son, who's been practicing meditation for about 4 years now, it's a Jedi skill. That's what he's learning. Nice. But yeah, I mean, that's another thing. You know, you can see mindfulness happening in schools, and that's an amazing thing for me to see. It's an amazing thing for me to even just hear other parents talking about. You know, I was very lucky that the school that my son went to, Bathgate, St Mary's, they introduced a mindfulness program there. So the teachers would teach the children mindfulness. If you ever get the chance to see a bunch of five-year-olds or primary ones doing mindfulness, just snap up that opportunity. There is nothing so funny as watching these little frontal lobe people trying to do some meditation, and then a sound, or the fact that their parents are in the room, they're just like, oh, oh. It's hysterical. It's the funniest thing I've ever seen. But yeah, but it's at the same time, it's a great skill to be teaching. It's the exact kind of skill you need to be teaching someone at that age, because it helps them with emotion regulation. It helps them to kind of take that moment to stop rather than lashing out. And you know, we do it before my son goes to bed, and he finds it hugely beneficial because he gets to sleep immediately. So it's a skill that I wish I'd been taught in school. Mm. And it's good to see that, you know, my son, he's so resilient. You know, some of the things that he comes home and he says, "Oh, this happened today, Daddy," and I'm like, "What?" He says, "But it's okay, it's all sorted." I'm like, "Oh, okay, that's fine. He's okay about this. That's great." And it's just this, and this kind of immediate reflection that he has, and a lot of that comes down to, I think, partly who he is, but I think also these skills that he's been taught since he was five. So it's remarkable, and I don't think he even knows that he's doing it half the time. I think that's the lovely part about it. It's just something that he's got.
That's amazing. I also had a conversation with Karen Gibb, who's also a mindfulness teacher for kids. For the listeners, a couple of episodes ago, you can listen back to...
Oh, fantastic. I will check that out, yeah.
So it was all about kids and mindfulness and meditation in schools. It was a brilliant conversation. And yeah, her experience is fantastic as well. And she says, like, yes, like teaching that to kids is exactly the same as teaching it to parents. It doesn't really differ that much.
Yeah.
Brains work the same.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, the brain, that's a great thing to say. The brains work the same. That's really true. Yeah, that's a good, I like that one. All brains work the same. It's the levelling ground. We all have one.
Yeah. Well, I hear quite a bit from people when I say, like, oh, I'm doing mindfulness and meditation, and it's just been really helpful. One of the first pushbacks is from people who haven't tried, they almost assume automatically that, oh, I cannot clear my head out that much. Like, I cannot sit there with an empty head and then just be with me. And I don't know where that image comes from, but I had that as well. And that kind of put me off for quite some time. But actually, it's what you explained is the complete opposite. It's about becoming more aware. So what would you suggest for the people who are a little bit maybe worried that they're not going to be able to sit still, not going to be able to clear their heads enough to meditate?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think a lot of people see meditation and they expect to feel relaxed. That's the thing. And a lot of that is in part of the way that meditation is marketed. You know, we see things like Headspace, we see things like these apps, you know, Calm, Breathe. These are all terms that people associate with being relaxed. It's all, you know, and I don't know But whenever I say to my wife, just relax, it's like it's like looking at touch paper, the worst thing you could say. So I think for some people, you know, this feeling of being told to that you need to do this to relax, you need to relax and chill out. I think that could be problematic. I think, you know, and the fact that we do look at meditation as being this, oh, it can calm you down, it can do all this, that's not what meditation's about. Meditation for me is never about wanting to feel relaxed. Meditation for me is much more about just connecting with who I am and connecting with where my brain's at. It's almost like looking at yourself underneath a microscope.
Mm.
You know, so you're kind of looking at your body, how your body feels, because your body's an amazing thing. Your body and mind are connected in such a way that you don't even realize it, and that we will feel our emotions in our body almost before we even know the emotions going on in our head. So, you know, when we're feeling anxious, we feel it in our tummy. When we're feeling happy, we also feel it around our heart. You know, different people experience emotions in different ways around their body. And by doing kind of meditation, it kind of almost gives you that early warning sign. So when you sense those sensations in your body, you think, okay, I know this is associated to a feeling and I can expect that feeling to happen. So yeah, for me, meditation is much more about tuning in. It's much more about being aware of what's going on. And if what's going on is that your mind is running around as if it's a drunk behind the wheel of a car smashing into anything that's going on, then that's just what's going on. That's just what's going on with your mind that day. And I think we need to forgive ourselves. We need to be kind to ourselves as well. And it's okay.
Mm.
It's okay to have days like that. There are days when I can't meditate. You know, my mind's too busy. I'll always try and do at least kind of a 3-minute meditation most days. But there are days that even that's too much and I just have to walk away from it. I don't get angry at myself. I don't say, oh, Alex, you're useless. Why can't you meditate today? So you say, well, that's just how it is today. And I think if we're kinder to ourselves and just look at each of these opportunities as exactly that, it's an opportunity to kind of realise where you're at, and that the end game is not to have an empty mind.
Mm.
The end game is not to be relaxed. The end game is, it's none of those things. It's just about connection. It's just about connecting with your mind and your body and being present. And if you can do that and your mind's going 10 to the dozen and there's all sorts of things going on the outside, that's what mindfulness gives you. It gives you that ability to kind of almost look at yourself through the lens of a friend. You know, so you wouldn't be angry with your friend if your friend was frustrated. You wouldn't be angry with your friend if your friend was having a bad time. You'd sit there and say to them, it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, be kind to yourself. So that's kind of what meditation does. It helps that kind of third person's perspective, if you like.
Yeah.
So the one thing I always say to people is don't get angry with yourself. Be kind to yourself. Expect your mind to wander. You know, our brains are neurologically wired to wander. We have this thing called the default network that kicks in all the time. It's why we daydream. It's why we have unique thoughts, in fact. And our brains can't stay on task for a very long time. You know, most kids, it's about 40 minutes. For adults, it's about 30 minutes max. You know, and it's really difficult for us to kind of stay focused on one topic. Our brains do it to give us a break. They do it deliberately to say, no, I need to context switch for a while. I can't keep doing this. I need to move on to something else. And just to kind of, you know, it's why we blink as well, to refresh what's going on in our head. And then we come back to it, we come back fresh. So that's what our default network's doing. And by practicing meditation, you're aware of when that happens and you're able to say, oh, okay, my mind's wandering. Oh, that's okay. I can let that happen for a bit and then I'll just gently bring myself back onto what I need to do. And it's like that with meditation. You notice your mind wandering. You accept it for a start. So I always use that kind of RAR. So recognize the fact that there's a thought or emotion come into your mind. Accept that that's just what your mind does. And then in the next breath, return to what you need to do. So, you know, it's a nice simple acronym that you can use and just brings yourself back to what you need to do within the meditation. And likewise, in having a mindful life, just recognize what's going on, accept that's what it is, and then return back to what you need to do.
Brilliant. Are there any other key benefits that you would like to emphasize from meditation and mindfulness practices?
Oh my word. So yeah, there are so many studies. There are so many studies. So I think in the last 10 years, there's been about 5,000 studies done onto mindfulness and meditation.
Wow.
You just go into Google and do a search for, you know, like studies for mindfulness meditation, you'd be inundated. Some of the big hitters, Stanford University have done some amazing studies. And there's a fantastic chap called Matteo Ricciard, who is a Buddhist monk, and he does a fantastic TED talk as well. He's a very, very funny man, and he's the world's happiest man. and that's his actual title, The World's Happiest Man. And one of the kind of benefits of meditation is he's in his 60s, but he has the brain age of a 40-year-old. You know, so there's one of the benefits. It actually increases the amount of grey matter you produce, increases the way the brain functions as well. When you meditate, you tend to use much more of your emotional center. So your decision-making, all your decision-making is rooted through that part of the brain as well. So it increases the connections there. So it means your decision-making can be much more centered and much better generally. Other benefits that they've been looking at. So out of all these benefits, health benefits, there are many. So it kind of reduces anxiety. People who suffer from chronic anxiety and acute anxiety can significantly reduce the impact of anxiety. Currently in Scotland, we use it to help support people who suffer from chronic pain. So as part of the National Pain Service in Scotland, they use a combination of acceptance commitment therapy, some drug therapy, and also using meditation and mindfulness to help people not get rid of their pain, but more change their experience of the pain. So again, it comes back to that. You're not trying to get rid of the thoughts. You're not trying to change your thoughts, but you're much more trying to change your relationship with them. So it's much more about changing the relationship with that person's pain. There was a huge meta-analysis study done in 2017 as well that showed that mindfulness meditation is as effective, in fact, more effective than drug therapy for people with high blood pressure. And under the NICE guidelines, I think it's just recently, the NICE guidelines now actually, first line of defense that you get is you'll get meditation rather than getting drug therapy because there's no side effects of meditation. Yeah. that's the great thing. There's no side effects. So that's the kind of the health benefits that we know. There's all the other stuff, you know, studies have shown that can help people with concentration levels, helps you get back onto task after being interrupted, helps you have much more clarity around your thinking, you know, knowing the difference between what's real and what's imagined. Our experience of the world is not necessarily what's really going on.
Yeah.
So again, people who tend to meditate tend to have much better insight of what's going on in their mind. But up until recently, we didn't understand why. And it's only really with neuroscientific research that we're starting to understand what's really going on when people meditate and how it's impacting those areas of the brain. So, you know, compassionate meditation actually enlarges that area of the brain that centers around compassionate emotions. People who do meditation for compassion produce oxytocin, which is the love drug. It's the reason why we fall in love with our children, why we fall in love with anyone. When you do meditation, it increases the flow of oxytocin into your body and enlarges those areas of the brain. And when you do mindfulness in the breath, it increases your frontal lobes, and more grey matter in the brain as well. So people under fMRIs can be seen to have larger areas of the brain there. There's a fantastic story about a very experienced meditator who has almost no startle reflex. And that's incredible. You know, that's something that's so ingrained into us, you know, that our startle reflex is something that's part of our old brain, that he's able to kind of almost dampen it down just through meditation, which is an incredible thing.
Sorry, can you elaborate what that reflex does?
You know, if you're holding the baby and you kind of just shuggle it and it does that little jump, you know, the little arms shoot out and it's like, oh, it's that little fear response. So if someone keeps up behind you and it goes, boo, you go, oh, that kind of like jump. It's that jump you get. That's the startle reflex. And it's something that's built into us as children. As babies, it's one of those hardwired reflexes that we have alongside the kind of the flight or fight kind of reflex, you know, that's it's all kind of wired into that. And this meditator had been doing it so long that he was able to almost completely dampen down the startle reflex.
Fantastic.
Which is an incredible, incredible statement. Now, I'm not saying that everybody's going to be able to do that, you know, that this is one case we're talking about. But the fact is that it does have an impact. You know, what's interesting about a lot of the studies is that it only needs to be done for 2 weeks. So just 2 weeks of a practice, of a dedicated practice, once or twice a day, is enough time to have an impact on things like selective happiness scales or, you know, your well-being scores. It can actually have an impact almost immediately just within 2 weeks. And then over time, you know, if you manage to get a practice for 6 weeks, over time it starts to have a serious impact on the shape of your brain. So that's an incredible thing. You know, something which is almost no side effects, you know, even for people with, you know, severe trauma, although they don't recommend meditation for people who've kind of had severe post-traumatic stress and things like that, there are some studies looking at using compassionate meditation for people who are going through trauma at the same time. So whilst actively experiencing the trauma or just coming straight out of the trauma, doing compassionate meditation to reframe their experience of that trauma and with themselves. Yeah, it's incredible. There's a wonderful story. Again, I can't remember the lady's name, but she did a TED talk where she talked about she was in a very abusive relationship and she would get up every morning and she would do what is essentially a compassionate meditation where she'd give herself compassion for herself and her children. And the reason she stayed in the relationship for so long as she did was for the safety of her children. She wanted to make sure that they were okay. And then the second that those kids had grown up and were able to go, she walked out. And she had this conversation with her therapist, and her therapist said, you need to tell the world. And that's what she did. So again, she's done a TED Talk.
Fantastic.
People that are doing things like this, maybe saying little prayers or doing little things to support themselves. And what they're actually doing is, it's a form of meditation. It's a form of being your own cheerleader.
Mm.
Within Western culture, we're so good at having inner critics that we don't have an inner cheerleader. Our negativity bias is huge. We're so quick to say, oh, stupid, I should have done that better. Or I could have been, maybe I shouldn't have talked so much. Or maybe I should have just listened to the person. Or maybe I should have done. And again, you see this all the time.
Mm.
But when you're able to kind of be compassionate about yourself, you can say, okay, perhaps I didn't do as well there as I could have. What can I learn from that? That's fine. Okay, you did the best you could at the time, which is a much more healthy response to have than, oh, you're stupid.
That is so true. Then when you started doing more of the mindfulness practices in the workplace and within your team, did you see the changes?
What started to happen, and this was really interesting, was my first experience of doing a large group mindfulness event was for the mental health network that we had there. And the lady who ran it asked me to come and do the talk that you've seen, funnily enough, to some people. And I said, yeah, sure, that'd be great. And I walked into the room and there was 185 people sitting in the room. And I had one of those moments where I went, oh, right, okay. So I did the session, so nervous, but I did the session and the session finished. And so many people came up to me after saying, Alex, that was amazing. Can you come to my team? Can you do this? And I was like, okay. And people who like yourself, had heard of meditation and heard of mindfulness, but had never experienced it, had never really practiced it, and who'd always heard this very much a religious, you know, spiritual woo sensation about the mindfulness, rather than here's a science-based approach, here's what mindfulness is. It's got nothing to do with any of that stuff, you know. Although that's its history, it doesn't mean that's what it is now. So that was really interesting. And then from that, I remember one time I was on a trip to London on my actual day job, and someone comes up to me and says, oh, Alex, how are you doing? I'm going, hi, who are you? Because there was like 180 people, and he was one of the people that had been at that session. He said, that's the first time I'd ever done meditation. And this was almost 6 months later. He says, I've done it every day since then. You've completely changed my life. Can you come and talk to my team? And I thought, yes, okay. And I've had a few of those moments,
aww,
whether it's been an email or it's been a phone call or just a kind of chance encounter. And when you hear someone say, you've changed my life, first of all, it's, you think, how can I affect someone in that way? You know, how can I kind of cause a ripple like that? And it kind of gives you the impetus to say, okay, if I can just affect one person's life for the positive in that way, then I'm going to keep doing this because it's important. And it's interesting you're talking about the impact there. The impact tends to be on people not of a younger age group. You know, I think a lot of people who are kind of Gen Z, Gen I don't know, they're sort of can't keep up with all the generations that we've got now, but you know, anybody who's like from the ages of 18 to 25, they already get it. They already know about mindfulness. They've probably got the app. They've probably read blogs. They're really in tune with a lot of this stuff already. Mm. But from that age group up, and especially my age group, kind of the 45s and ups, they are like, oh, mindfulness isn't for me. That's a young person's game. You know, like that's all a bit woo, isn't it? Often when I do the sessions to that kind of cohort, that's when I get the biggest transformation. Those are the people that come up to me after and say, that was remarkable. I've never experienced anything like that. And they're the ones that are really shocked by it, you know, because they're dealing with all that baggage that mindfulness is this kind of woo, zen type spirituality thing. And when they kind of come out and go and realise, actually, no, it's just paying attention to your breath for 5 minutes. Wow. And I feel amazing and I feel relaxed, and I didn't expect to feel relaxed. I thought this was all just rubbish, but you know, they come out of it just feeling great. That's really remarkable to see.
That sounds great, and that sounds like such a great experience for you as well to be a part of. Did you come across any resistance when you started speaking about mindfulness in the workplace? Did you have any challenges that you had to overcome to keep doing these sessions?
I think I've been lucky in some senses, because especially just now, my line manager, my boss, who is excellent, Alan, he's been really, really good, because he was like, just said, yeah, you just do it. It works for you. It helps. But I have to say, he always says to me, tell people where you work and what you do and which team you work for. So that way, you know, but when you're talking to all these people, they've heard of you and they've heard of our team. And I'm like, that's fine. Okay. So there's that kind of selfless promotion. But before that, I think a lot of it was probably just me. What I've been amazed at is that most people are wanting to hear this. Most people want to talk about it, or will at least listen. Mm. There's very few people that have completely turned away from it. There's been the dissenters. There's always been the people that think, this isn't really for me. But they're the ones that have kind of probably turned around going, actually, I was really surprised how much I got out of that. So I think a lot of it was just believing in myself and believing in the fact that, you know, I've got something to say that people want to listen to. I think a lot of the time I was thinking, nobody's going to want to listen to me talk about meditation, and just having enough belief in myself to go and say, actually, this is something I want to talk about. Here's what it is. And when I started to do that, and I started to get that confidence, I was like, actually, yeah, okay. And I found that there's less and less people say no, and more people say yeah. So it's been an interesting journey. So I think for me, it was much more about myself getting over my own worries and my own fears about talking about something like this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because we all have this thing about mental health, and mental health has always been seen as something of a bit of a taboo subject. Yeah. And mindfulness and meditation are also a part of spirituality. And again, that's often seen as being something of a very taboo subject. You know, we don't often talk about religion in the way that we used to. You know, we often feel worried about sharing what our religious beliefs, because we think, people think that person believes in God. Mm. But people should be allowed to have their beliefs, and we should respect those beliefs no matter what they are. We don't need to agree with them, but you can still respect someone who votes for a party that you don't necessarily believe in, no matter how outlandish that might be, but you can still have some common ground. Mm. And I think that's the thing that kind of mindfulness has taught me. It's just having that belief in yourself that when you talk about something that you're passionate about and that's aligned to your values, people will listen to you. And yeah, I think most of the time I've not had any really negative issues with it at all. And I've been lucky.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think that's so many people's story, mine included. I wasn't speaking about my mental health for ages. I did bring it up amongst some of my friends, and some were really responsive, and some were like, oh, yeah, I'm not sure like what's going on there. Do you just maybe want to go have dinner and hang out instead of talking to a therapist? And it's a really interesting transition. But at the end of the day, the more you speak about it, the more normalized it becomes. And then actually,
this is it.
No one really cares that much about me as I was worried about.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think if we all realize that we all come from a position of trauma, every human being has experienced some form of trauma in their past. And that can be something very, very small, or something really, really huge. But if we all kind of look at each other as, you know, this person's come from a place of trauma, then we can reframe any conversation we have with that person. You know, it's not necessarily that person's a bad person. Their experiences in their life have shaped who they are. And we know that. We know, you know, the science behind it shows that there's no such thing as nature over nurture. It is nurture 100% all the time. And by allowing ourselves to do better, and by looking at ourselves, and again, being really compassionate combined to ourselves and others, it allows us to get past a lot of that baggage. So I think it's really important. And the fact that we can have conversations, the fact that you've got a blog about this kind of stuff just now, talking about mental health, I think it's a wonderful thing you're doing. You know, and you're empowering other people as well as yourself to talk about the mental health and talk about ways that people can cope with it. I think it's a really important thing for us to have those conversations, because you're right, it normalizes it. Mm. It makes it something that you can just talk about, you know, and if we can get to that point in, you know, kind of 3 or 4 years' time, people are just talking about mental health as if they were talking about how they were talking about cancer,
yeah,
or how they were talking about any other health condition, because that's what it is. It's just a health condition. Exactly. But because it's just because it's got the mental label on it, people think, oh, right, okay. And it's that connotation that we're starting to see a shift in, and I think that's really important. Mm. And at the same time as that conversation's happening, we're seeing people be much more accepting of things like meditation and mindfulness. And that is an important transition that we're seeing.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. And there's also like this, almost like a spectrum to every mental health issue that we speak about. When I was growing up, you were okay, or you were like on the way to asylum.
It was binary, wasn't it? It was very much on or off. You know, yeah, you'd always hear the terms like, oh, you're mental or you're okay. Yeah. And again, those terms weren't helpful. You know, I think things have taught us now, you know, that the way we refer to mental health and the way we help people is about phrasing the conversation in the right way. Mm. Not just having the conversation, but making sure that conversation isn't dismissed and that people feel listened to. And it's a difficult thing to do. It's a difficult thing for people to change. Change is not an easy thing to do. Human beings will always revert to the norm. You know, it's we always revert to the mean, and we have an inherent negativity bias. So, and that's not our fault. Mm. That's not our fault at all. That's our brains. That's our brains just doing what they're designed to do, just trying to keep us safe. Yeah. And they do that by, you know,
expecting the worst, making sure to save yourself from the situation.
It's why we're the most successful creatures on this planet. You know, evolution has given us this lovely brain that is just not very good in the modern world. You know, it's just simple as that. Evolution hasn't caught up with where we are. That's really it. Things getting quicker and faster on the kind of crazy logarithmic scale. Our brains cannot keep up. You know, we're used to kind of a much slower pace of life. You know, our modern brain is only, 20,000 years old, really, 20,000 to 40,000 years old. That's very new.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Learning compassion and learning self-care and learning kindness and all that. It's almost like you have that, but your automatic response, like your fight or flight mode, just goes to the negativity bias. Mm-hmm. And then you practice so hard become more empathetic, become more kind, like towards yourself. Yeah. First of all, and then everyone else as well.
It's interesting, having had two boys and who are both very compassionate little children, I often think it's all about how we bring up our kids. You know, that's really important. You know, it's so important. And you can see that the schools are focusing on building the skills to make little humans that can be compassionate to one another. And dealing with resolution of conflict in very different ways than they would have done when I was at school. You know, I remember getting, you know, capital punishment. I got the belt when I was in primary three. So, you know, like, so it's a very different world now. It's a very, very different world. And I think that's a good thing because my two boys are so confident, so resilient, and at the same time will work things out. And it's really lovely to see. And I hope that continues. I hope they don't get stunted in the way that a lot of my generation and kind of other generations have been. You can see it in young kids. They will happily cuddle each other if someone else has been upset. They will go to each other, they'll cuddle each other, they will support each other. It's a natural human reaction. And it's, especially in young men, it's horrible to see, but the kind of toxic masculinity, and that's not to say men are toxic, it's just our pervasion of this, that men need to be a certain way to be a man, which I think is horrific. The less of that we see, the better. The more that men can just be just humans. Yeah. Right? It's not about being a man, it's not about being a woman, it's just about being a human. And human beings are designed to be these compassionate individuals that support one another. You know, we're a collaborative species. We work better when we work together. So when you look at the neuroscience, when you look at how we're kind of made, that's what it's about. And society's norms is what's changed the human being. Yeah. We're no longer human beings, we're human doings. And I think that if we can get more back to being a human being and in just being where we are and being present, we'd have a very different existence.
That's so true. Can I ask you to give us a little example of what mindfulness meditation can be for the listeners? Maybe there's someone who hasn't tried it before. Could we maybe take a couple of minutes and do a little meditation together?
Yeah, I'd love to. I thought about this and I thought a nice meditation to do is a very simple meditation called the three-step meditation. And it's kind of three stages. It's very, very simple. We just bring a self-awareness to where we are now. We begin an awareness of our breath and then an awareness of our body. And it takes about kind of 3 minutes. And it's something that I've introduced to some of my meetings that I chair. We call it a moment to arrive, a little moment just to settle in. So we'll do that, shall we? So this is quite nice to do. So if you'd like to just get yourself comfortable with your feet uncrossed and flat on the floor, your hands resting on your lap, either palms up or palms down, whatever's comfortable for you. And you can either close your eyes or just simply have your gaze being soft, gazing away into space, and just take a moment. And take a moment to notice how you feel. And if you can, just bring one word to mind that signifies how you feel at this time. You don't need to overthink it. Normally the first word that comes to mind is how you're feeling. Just notice anything going on around you. Be aware of the sounds in the room, even the sounds outside. Just gathering a sense of where you are right now. In this moment. And gently, deliberately turn your attention towards your breath. Taking a deep breath in through your nose and then slowly exhale gently again through your nose. Notice the in-breath, the out-breath, and that quiet space in between. Whatever the breath feels like for you in this moment. And see if you can become aware of your breathing. Notice your breath without changing it. Just noticing the sensations in your body as you breathe in and out. Noticing the gentle rise on the in-breath and the letting go on the out-breath. See if you can notice the different areas of the body the breath touches. The front of your abdomen, perhaps the sides and even your back. Where do you notice the breath the most in your body? Just settle there now, being aware of the different elements of breath. Now you can gently broaden, expand your awareness from the breath to the whole of your body. Becoming aware of your body sitting on the chair, the contact with the back of the chair, with your hips, your bottom, the back of your thigh. Noticing the weight of your feet on the floor. What can you feel right now? What sensations are going on right now? You don't need to focus on any particular area. Just get a sense of what's going on and allow yourself to be aware of it. Feel the weight and shape of your body as you sit here. Feel the whole body breathe as if you're breathing into your toes and your fingers and your head. You can broaden your awareness further now by becoming aware of the sounds both inside and outside of the room. Noticing the light on your eyelids. And when you're ready and in your own time, you can gently open your eyes and bring yourself fully back to the here and now. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, what are the things that people mostly experience after these meditations?
Funnily enough, when I used to do these face-to-face, we used to get a lot of people falling asleep. So you'd see a lot of nodding dogs, as I like to put it. But I think for the people that had never done meditation, there was a real moment of surprise. Normally we would do anything between kind of eight. I'd always say when I was doing the talks, well, we'll do 5 minutes of meditation, knowing full well that I'll do 12 to 14 minutes. So that when they come out of it, they say, well, that was 12 minutes. That couldn't have been 12 minutes. It only felt like it was 30 seconds. That's the really good thing. But I think most people always report feeling greater clarity of thought, certainly more energized. And that's a very common after effect, although it does depend on the time of day that you do it. So this is an interesting thing with meditation. If you do meditation around about lunchtime, certainly before lunch rather than after lunch, you do get like this little kind of burst of energy, this kind of sense of, oh yeah, okay, I can crack on with the afternoon. And likewise, if you do it in the morning. However, if you do it at night, especially before going to bed, it's almost like it helps magnify the sensations of what needs to happen in that moment. Because again, the point of meditation is not to feel more energized and not to feel more relaxed. It's just to be present with where you are at that moment. So at nighttime, it's about connecting with the fact that, oh, I'm tired, I need to go to sleep. And you tend to get a much better night's sleep because of it. Generally, at the sessions that I've done, most people report feeling just kind of clearer, relaxed as a common side effect. You know, a lot of people say, oh, I feel much more relaxed, I feel much better. And generally people say, yeah, I'm really looking forward to the rest of the day.
Thank you for sharing that. That's really fantastic. No worries. And what would you suggest for people who are looking to start doing some meditation and some mindfulness? Where would you suggest to go? What tools would you suggest to use? Because there's so much out there.
There is so much out there. It's ridiculous, just the number of apps and things. So I always say to people, start with what's free. Insight Timer is a free app. You can get a premium option, but it's a really good opportunity. And they, in conjunction with LinkedIn, have a 40-day mindfulness course on there. And it's got lots of very, very good teachers that are on there. So all the kind of the big hitters in mindfulness. Great thing about that session is it kind of goes through all the techniques that you do, so things like body scan to breathing meditations to compassionate meditations and gratitude. So it really covers the lot. Check out some of the big movers and shakers. For me, John Kabat-Zinn, great person to check out. Got lots of really useful information on his website and lots of free meditations as well. Jack Kornfield, I've mentioned already, he's fantastic. Jack's a bit more spiritual in his approach, but again, just depends on what you like. Tara Brach is fantastic. She's a psychologist and a mindfulness teacher as well. She's big on compassion, and she's got a brilliant book called Radical Compassion Using Rain, which is a really, really interesting read. And if you can get the audiobook for that, because it's lovely, because she reads the book too, and she's got one of the most wonderful voices to listen to. Meditations are on there as well, and she's got lots of free resources. Russ Harris, again, of kind of big in the acceptance commitment therapy, he's got some fantastic meditations as well. There's so much out there, but definitely checking out the kind of movers and shakers, that's always a good place to start. Headspace is a good app. I think it's a bit pricey for those people that need to buy it, but they've got a Netflix show on just now, which is quite good, and it's a nice gentle introduction to what mindfulness is about. That's a really good one. I think mindful.org is another good one as well. It's got lots of information on there. But yeah, just read up about it and get as much as you can, I suppose. You very quickly find out what works for you. And I think that's the thing. It's even if one meditation doesn't work, try something else. So for me, it came down to finding a teacher that I could listen to. I often find that it's the tone of the voice and the style of the voice. If that doesn't work for you, then it will never work for you. And again, if you want to get more into the spiritual side of things and, you know, the spirituality side of it, really captures you, then there are roots into that. So, you know, looking at things like Buddhism, Hinduism, there are kind of meditations in those spaces as well. Just having an interest is great. That's often enough. Do have a look at some of the apps. Always go with the free apps initially first. Breathworks is really good, actually. They've got fantastic pages as well, especially if you're interested in mindfulness and meditation for health. Their stuff is purely about how it can support you from a health benefit. And Viri Mellon-Birch does a fantastic talk on our website around mindfulness and how it can support people with long COVID. But the Breathworks app's really good. It was actually developed to coincide with their course and to support people that do the course. But the app's free, and it essentially gives you a whole kind of 8 weeks worth of meditations that you can follow if people are interested in courses. So the one thing about being in the UK is make sure if you're going to do a course, do one that's BAMBA certified. So that's the British Association of Mindfulness. They certify content. So things like the mindfulness-based stress reduction courses, they tend to be BAMBA certified. So make sure your teacher's BAMBA certified as well. So that's one thing I would recommend. It just means that you're going to get a decent standard of a person doing the course for you.
I've done some of those. They were really, really good as well. Yeah, I can agree on that.
Yeah. And there's one other guy, a chap called Professor Paul Gilbert, who wrote a fantastic book called The Compassionate Mind. And it's a very important read. It's a brilliant therapeutical approach. This is much more about using compassion-focused therapy to kind of help people develop a sense of kindness on themselves and connect with themselves in a very different way.
Fantastic. Thank you. I'll get some of the links from you and I'll add it in the show notes as well for people to quickly find that.
Perfect.
Amazing. If people are interested in getting in touch with you, what is the best way to do that? Through your LinkedIn profile?
Yeah, LinkedIn. LinkedIn's a way to go. Just find me at Alex Reynolds. I do have a Facebook page. It's called Virtual Meditation by Alex Reynolds. sort of original title, as you can tell. That's a, it's a kind of closed Facebook group. I set it up at the start of lockdown for people who wanted to do meditation at night, and it went quite well. I think we've got about 450 members or something on there. But if you like listening to my voice doing meditation, you can go on there. There's a whole load of videos of me leading meditations, and there's various themes and stuff like that, so you can check that out.
Thank you. I'll add that link as well. Alex, it has been absolutely amazing having you. Enjoy the conversation as always. Yeah, just really big thank you. And hopefully we can work on some more conversations in the near future.
I would love that. And thank you very much for having me today. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I really hope you enjoyed it and there were some valuable learnings for you to take away. If you like this podcast, please follow me, leave a review about what you enjoyed so I can do more of that, and maybe tell a friend if you think they might like this as well. Every little does help. You can also find me on Instagram, LinkedIn, and on my website. Links are in my show notes. Thank you, and I will meet you on the next episode of Conversations with My Mind in a fortnight on your favorite podcast platform.